Picture this. You're walking down the street, maybe you're on your way to grab a coffee or heading to work, and you pass by this massive glass office building. Or maybe it's, one of those sprawling, endless logistics warehouses right off the highway.
Yeah, those things are huge.
Right, or just a bustling retail center. And you look up at these concrete giants and you just have to wonder, who actually owns this and
Exactly.
how exactly are they making money off it? Because I think it's really easy to assume that commercial real estate is just this, well, this playground for institutional billionaires and massive corporations.
Oh, for sure. It feels totally out of reach for normal people.
Yeah. But today we are doing a deep dive into the actual mechanics behind commercial real estate investment.
We are.
We're going to break down how this ecosystem actually operates, the structural risks involved, and the very real roadmap that exists for getting involved in this space today.
Because there really is a roadmap for beginners, which is what our sources today are all about.
Exactly. We've got some great material that lays out a beginner's guide to this whole world.
Okay, let's unpack this. To start, we need to draw a hard line. What exactly separates a commercial property from, say, the house or apartment you might live in?
Well, at its core, commercial real estate, or CRE, as people call it, is basically any property used primarily for business purposes.
Okay.
Its fundamental existence, the whole reason it's there, is to generate income.
Right.
Because most people are, very familiar with residential real estate, like single-family homes, maybe a
Yeah,
duplex.
you buy it to live in it.
Exactly. Or you rent it out to someone who just needs a place to sleep.
Makes sense.
But the commercial space operates on a completely different scale. I mean, we're talking about office buildings, which could be anything from tiny co-working spaces to massive corporate headquarters. We're looking at retail properties too. So that stands from local strip malls all the way up to those giant shopping centers.
Right.
Then there are industrial properties, think factories, massive warehouses, logistics hubs, the ones you see off the interstate.
Exactly. So, and we also include hospitality in this bucket, which covers hotels and resorts.
Oh, okay. I would have immediately thought of hotels.
Yeah, their business is housed in a property. And there is actually one specific overlap with residential that falls into the commercial category,
What's that?
multifamily housing. But there's a strict distinction here. It only refers to apartment complexes with five or more units.
Wait, really? Why five?
I know, right?
That seems like such an arbitrary number to just like flip a switch from a residential property to a commercial one.
It does seem random, but it actually comes down to how the asset is valued and financed by the banks.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so if you buy a four-unit building, a bank looks at your personal income, your credit score, to approve the loan.
Because it's basically just a house to them.
Right. But once you hit five units, the property achieves a certain scale where the bank evaluates the asset itself as a standalone business.
Oh, I
They
see.
look at something called the debt service coverage ratio.
Debt service coverage ratio. What does that actually mean for the buyer?
Basically, it means they ask, does this building generate enough independent revenue to pay its own mortgage, regardless of what your personal day job income is?
Wow.
Yeah, it's evaluated entirely on its ability to generate revenue. And that structural shift brings us to why investors are so drawn to this space.
Because it's treated like a business.
Exactly. But the real appeal is heavily rooted in the structure of the lease agreements themselves.
Right, because residential leases are what, usually a year?
Yeah, typically a one-year agreement. But commercial tenants often sign much, much longer leases. We are talking anywhere from 3 to 10 years.
Wow, 10 years.
Sometimes up to 20 years for major anchor tenants, like a big grocery store and a shopping center.
20 years. I mean, that completely changes the math for an investor.
Completely.
Because when I think about residential real estate, it's kind of like having a roommate.
Right, that's a good way to look at it.
Like a roommate who might leave in a few months, and right before they move out, they break the fridge.
Of course they do.
And you're left scrambling to find a new person to take their room, and you have to pay out of pocket to replace the appliance yourself.
Yep, you're on the hook.
But commercial real estate feels much more like a corporate partnership.
What's fascinating here is the absolute alignment of incentives, and it's heavily driven by a mechanism called a triple net lease, or NNN.
Triple net lease. Okay, how does that work?
So, in a standard residential setup, like your roommate example, the landlord pays the property taxes, the building insurance, and the maintenance costs out of the rent they collect.
Right, that's just part of being a landlord.
But in a triple net commercial lease, the tenant actually takes on those three major expenses.
Wait, the tenant pays the property taxes.
Yes. The business pays a base rent to the owner,
Yeah.
and then they directly cover the taxes, the insurance, and the cost to fix that break-in fridge.
That is wild. I mean, I guess if you run a high-end retail store, you can't really have a leaky roof or a broken air conditioner anyway, right? It ruins your customer experience and damages your inventory. So the tenant is naturally motivated to keep the property in pristine condition.
Because it is the physical manifestation of their brand.
Yeah, it's their storefront.
They have a vested business interest in maintaining the property. Professional tenants just make property management significantly more streamlined for the owner.
That makes total sense.
Plus, a single retail or office tenant is often paying substantially more per square meter than multiple residential tenants combined.
So you're making more money with less headache.
You have higher income potential, longer lease terms that offer predictability, and professional tenants who literally share the burden of upkeep.
It sounds like a dream.
It creates a highly stable income environment.
But wait, earlier you said professional tenants are a safety net.
Yeah.
But a 10-year lease doesn't mean anything if the company goes bankrupt in year three, right?
Ah, that is the catch.
Because if I have a one-bedroom apartment and my tenant loses their job and moves out, I just lower the rent by 50 bucks.
Right, put it on a rental app.
Exactly. I put it on a rental app and I have a new tenant by the weekend because everybody needs a place to sleep.
That's the residential advantage.
Right. But if I own a highly specialized, custom-fitted logistics warehouse or like a massive cold storage facility, and that company goes under,
It's a huge problem.
you can't just drop the rent 50 bucks and put a specialized pharmaceutical warehouse on Craigslist.
No, you definitely cannot. And if we connect this to the bigger picture from our sources, you are hitting on the critical concept of vacancy risk.
Vacancy risk.
This is where commercial real estate is uniquely unforgiving.
Because there aren't that many people who need a cold storage facility.
Exactly. You cannot apply residential thinking to a commercial asset. If a specialized commercial space goes vacant, it might sit empty for 6 months,
Oh, man.
or a year, or even longer. The pool of businesses looking for a 50,000 square foot refrigerated warehouse with specialized loading docks is vastly smaller than the pool of people looking for a one-bedroom apartment.
Right. And while it's sitting empty for a year, you are still paying the mortgage on that massive commercial loan.
Every single month.
This actually reminds me of the danger of adjustable rate mortgages on personal homes, but like on steroids.
That's a really good comparison.
It's like taking out a mortgage with a variable rate, but multiplying the principal by 50.
Yeah, the numbers are terrifying.
Because if your commercial property sits vacant and your loan terms suddenly adjust upward by just 1 or 2 percentage points, your entire profit margin for the year is instantly wiped out.
Gone.
You don't just have a bad month, you have a catastrophic failure.
And that is the exact mechanism of over-leveraging.
Over-leveraging.
Borrowing too much money without a financial cushion is a primary reason commercial investors fail.
Because they just look at the best case scenario.
Right. A property might look incredibly profitable when you run the numbers with a tenant currently in place.
Sure, the spreadsheet looks great.
But if interest rates rise, the cost of servicing your debt goes up.
Yeah.
And if that specialized tenant leaves concurrently and you haven't factored a long vacancy period into your cash flow estimates, the bank will eventually take the asset.
They just foreclose on it.
Yep. It requires rigorous financial forecasting, building buffers for unexpected capital expenditures like a new roof, and understanding that macroeconomic trends basically dictate your success.
Macroeconomic trends, that's huge. Because to see how these macro forces play out on the ground, you just have to look at a hypergrowth market.
Definitely.
And the sources highlight that the ongoing transformation in Saudi Arabia illustrates perfectly how regional trends directly impact these concrete giants.
It's a fascinating case study.
It really is. In Riyadh, there's a massive surge in demand for warehouse and logistics spaces.
Unprecedented demand, really.
And the driving force behind it is e-commerce. The more consumer behavior shifts to ordering online, the more physical space is required in the real world to store, sort, and ship those goods.
The digital economy still requires a massive physical footprint.
Yeah, you can't store physical boxes in the cloud.
It's the physical backbone of the digital world. And Riyadh is leading in logistics precisely because of that shift in infrastructure needs.
Okay, so that's Riyadh, but what about other areas?
Well, if you shift focus to Jeddah, you see a completely different financial opportunity, specifically regarding retail yields.
Retail yields. Let's define that really quick.
Yeah, so yield is essentially the annual return on your investment based on the property's income.
Okay.
Jetta is currently offering very attractive retail yields because the entry prices, the cost to actually buy the commercial property, are lower compared to the capital.
Okay, let's break down the math on that yield because I think it's a crucial mechanic for people to understand.
Yeah, let's do the math.
So if a commercial building in Riyadh costs $2 million and generates $100,000 a year in rent, that's a 5% yield.
Right.
But if you find a retail space in Jeddah that generates that exact same $100,000 in rent, but only costs $1.25 million to buy,
your yield jumps to 8%.
Exactly. It's a huge difference.
That lower barrier to entry for the physical asset dramatically shifts the return profile for the investor.
Absolutely.
Then you have NEOM, which introduces a completely different dynamic.
Right. NEOM is like something out of a sci-fi movie.
It really is. It's this massive development targeting high-tech industries and global investors with premium, futuristic commercial zones.
It's essentially building an entirely new market from scratch.
But navigating these varying regional opportunities as a foreign investor requires understanding the specific policy mechanisms at play.
Because you can't just wire money from overseas and claim a skyscraper.
Far from it. Recent reforms do allow non-Saudis to buy commercial property, but it is heavily regulated.
There are hoops to jump through.
A lot of hoops. The investment typically needs to actively support the nation's broader economic development goals.
Which means aligning with initiatives like Vision 2030.
Exactly. Practically speaking, this means a foreign investor must secure licensing through the Ministry of Investment.
The Ministry of Investment?
Yes. It involves proving that the capital you are bringing in will generate economic activity rather than just passively sitting on real estate.
They want to see actual growth, not just land hoarding.
Precisely.
Speaking of generating economic activity, there's the impact of massive mega projects in these areas.
All the mega projects are game changers.
Places like the King Abdullah Financial District, or KAFD, and Jeddah Economic City. Buying an office space right next to KAFD is basically like opening an independent boutique coffee shop right next to the construction site of a massive new university.
That is a brilliant analogy.
Because on one hand, it could be the greatest decision of your life. If the university opens and suddenly there are 50,000 students looking for coffee, the demand vastly outpaces supply.
And everyone wants coffee.
Right. So the value of your little coffee shop skyrockets because everyone wants to be near the action.
And this brings us back to vacancy and competition risk.
Exactly. Because what's the flip side?
Well, what if the university realizes they have a captive audience and they decide to build their own giant state-of-the-art food court right on campus?
With like three major chain coffee shops inside.
Right. Suddenly, your boutique coffee shop is facing immense, well-funded competition.
It's terrifying.
Or what if the university's construction gets delayed by 4 years due to supply chain issues?
Oh man, then you're sitting there with an empty coffee shop paying a premium lease, waiting for foot traffic that doesn't exist yet.
Mega developments introduce massive opportunity, but they also act like a gravitational black hole.
A black hole?
Yeah, they can either pull customers toward your asset or entirely eclipse it.
This is why understanding zoning laws and municipal planning is so critical. You have to know what is permitted to be built next door to you before you buy.
That local intelligence is paramount.
You can't just guess.
No. Having local legal advisors, property surveyors, and consultants isn't a luxury. It is a structural necessity.
It's just part of the cost of doing business.
You need experts who understand the licensing variations from region to region, the specific zoning laws, and the nuances of the local tenant pool.
Because if you don't,
navigating foreign ownership regulations without local counsel is a guaranteed way to tie up your capital in bureaucratic limbo.
Yeah, that sounds like a nightmare. So let's take a step back and look at the listener who is exploring this space right now.
Okay.
We've talked about the structural benefits, you know, the triple net leases, the professional tenants maintaining the asset.
The good stuff.
Right. But we've also unpacked the massive risks, the long vacancy periods, the danger of variable interest rates on massive commercial loans, the intense legal complexity, and of course, the reliance on hyper-local geographic trends.
It is a lot to weigh.
It is. So how does someone actually take the first step without taking on millions in debt or getting crushed by the complexity?
Well, it requires choosing an entry point that matches your available capital and your personal risk tolerance.
Okay, what are the options?
The traditional roadmap offers a few distinct routes. The first is direct ownership.
Direct ownership.
This is buying the physical building yourself. It gives you absolute full control over the asset, but it requires high capital, intense management effort, and you carry 100% of the vacancy and leverage risk.
You are the one responsible if the specialized tenant goes bankrupt and the bank comes knocking.
Exactly. It's all on your shoulders.
What's the next route?
The second route involves property funds or syndicates.
Syndicates.
This is where multiple investors pool their capital together to buy larger assets.
So you're not going it alone.
Right. It lowers your individual financial barrier to entry and shares the risk among a group of limited partners.
But there's a trade-off, right?
Yeah, you sacrifice control over the day-to-day management decisions to a general partner.
Okay, that makes sense.
And the third traditional route is real estate investment trusts, or REITs.
Ah, REITs. I've heard of these.
These act much like publicly traded stocks. You are buying shares in a corporation that owns, operates, or finances income-producing real estate.
The mechanics of REITs are actually brilliant for a hands-off approach.
They really are.
Because to qualify as a REIT and avoid corporate income tax, the company is legally required to pay out the vast majority of its taxable income, usually around 90%, directly to shareholders in the form of dividends.
It's a fantastic structure.
So you get the high liquidity of a stock combined with the consistent cash flow generated by commercial rent, and it requires zero maintenance on your part.
No broken fridges to worry about.
Ah.
It is often the most practical starting point for gaining exposure to the commercial market without dealing with physical property management.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though.
Oh.
What about the middle ground?
The middle ground.
Yeah, because direct ownership is incredibly capital intensive, and REITs offer zero control and abstract your ownership away from a specific building. You just own stock in a giant portfolio. Is there a mechanism for someone who wants actual, tangible asset ownership of a specific property, but doesn't have a multi-million dollar down payment?
Yes.
This is where fractional investing platforms like Osul Gamma come into play. It operates almost like crowdfunding a skyscraper.
Crowdfunding a skyscraper. I love that. To understand how platforms like Osul Gamma work, we have to look at the legal mechanism they utilize.
Okay. What is it?
It's called a special purpose vehicle, or SPV.
Special purpose vehicle.
When a platform identifies a lucrative commercial asset, say a highly demanded logistics warehouse in Riyadh, they create an SPV.
And what does the SPV actually do?
It is a standalone legal entity created specifically to purchase and hold that single property.
Oh, I see. So instead of needing the capital to bake the entire pie yourself, you know, securing the massive commercial loan, dealing with the zoning boards, hiring the surveyors, you buy a digital share of that SPV.
Exactly. You legally own a fraction of the equity in that specific warehouse.
Which entitling you to a proportional slice of the rental income it generates?
Yes. This mechanism represents a fundamental democratization of finance.
Democratization, that's a big word, but it fits perfectly here.
It really does. Platforms like Osul Gamma are taking specific, tangible deals that were historically locked away and reserved exclusively for institutional investors or ultra-high net worth individuals, and making them accessible through fractional equity.
Which is huge.
You get the direct correlation to a specific physical asset without having to personally negotiate a 10-year lease or fix a commercial HVAC system.
Which I definitely do not know how to do.
Most people don't. But even with easier access, the fundamental principles of commercial investing remain unchanged.
So what are the core rules that apply across the board, whether you buy a building directly or buy a fractional share in an SPV?
There are three main ones. First, think long term.
Think long term.
Commercial real estate is inherently illiquid and operates on a game of patience. You're looking for steady, predictable income and capital appreciation over a timeline of years, if not decades.
It's not a get-rich-quick scheme.
Not at all. Second, partner smartly.
Partner smartly.
Utilizing vetted platforms, hiring local legal experts, or joining a structured syndicate reduces your blind spots and mitigates risk.
Don't try to be a hero and do it all yourself.
Exactly. And third, reinvest your profits.
Reinvest.
When your commercial asset starts generating that steady dividend or rental income, deploy those returns into new opportunities.
The snowball effect.
Exactly. This creates a compounding effect, allowing you to organically accelerate your portfolio's growth rather than constantly relying on taking out new, high-interest external debt.
That makes a lot of sense. So what does this all mean for you, the listener? We started this deep dive by looking up at a towering office building and wondering how the machinery inside it works.
Then we've definitely examined the gears.
We really have. We've seen that it's not just a concrete box, it's a financial instrument governed by triple net leases, driven by professional tenants who shoulder the operating costs.
But we've also seen the trapdoors.
Oh, yeah. How leverage can wipe out profits, the devastating reality of vacancy risk, and how local developments can drastically alter your property's value.
The black hole of mega projects.
Exactly. But most importantly, we've explored how the barrier to entry has structurally shifted.
It has.
Through syndicates, the dividend mechanics of REITs, and the SPVs utilized by fractional platforms like Osol Gamma, the walls around this asset class are coming down.
This raises an important question regarding how to approach these new avenues.
Okay, what is it?
Success in real estate isn't about perfectly timing the market.
It's not.
No. Trying to predict the exact bottom or the absolute peak of interest rates or property values is a fool's errand.
So what is it about?
Success is about time in the market. It's about making rigorously informed decisions based on local data, understanding the legal landscape, preparing your cash reserves for the worst-case vacancy scenario.
Always have a buffer.
Always.
Yeah.
And then having the patience to let the mechanics of the lease compound your returns over the long haul.
It's about systemic preparation, not just luck. So we want to leave you with a final thought to mull over today.
Yeah, think about this.
We spent a lot of time talking about how macro trends reshape physical spaces, like how the boom in e-commerce transformed empty desert outside of Riyadh into incredibly valuable logistics hubs.
The physical footprint of the digital world.
Right. So tomorrow, when you're taking that walk and looking at the commercial spaces in your own neighborhood, ask yourself this: as our digital habits continue to evolve, which of the traditional, everyday commercial buildings around you right now are destined to become obsolete?
That's a great question.
And more importantly, what kind of new, innovative physical infrastructure is going to have to be built to take their place?
Because the landscape is always shifting.
It is, and the investors who win are the ones who understand the mechanics of what comes next. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive.
It's been great.
We'll catch you next time.